From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. A second Texas nurse is being treated for Ebola after the CDC gave her a green light to fly. The CDC and the Texas hospital, where both nurses were infected, racing now to institute the kinds of measures that should have been in place all along. We've had words of reassurance, but what's the reality? This hour on Point, Ebola, the American response so far, and what it's going to take to contain this, to stop it in its tracks. A news conference yesterday, Dallas Mayor Mike Rawlings said that people should not be frightened by the Ebola cases among hospital workers.
We want to deal with facts, not fear. And I continue to believe that while Dallas is anxious about this, and with this news this morning, the anxiety level goes up a level, we are not fearful.
Yes, anxiety up a level, not fearful. Well, people really wondering. At that conference, Dallas County Judge Clay Jenkins, the local official overseeing the emergency response now to Ebola in Dallas, said it would not be a surprise if other healthcare workers at the same hospital test positive for Ebola.
We have a situation involving 77 people, two of which have tested positive for Ebola. We are preparing contingencies for more, and that is a very real possibility.
77 people, that's at the hospital or around it. That doesn't include those who were on the plane that the second nurse took. At a news conference yesterday, 130-plus of those Dr. Daniel Varga here, Chief Clinical Officer for Texas Health Resources. That's the company that owns Texas Health Presbyterian Hospital. Said it is still not known how the two nurses were infected.
We're looking at every element of our personal protective equipment and infection control inside the hospitals. We don't have an answer for this right now, but we're looking at every possible angle around this.
The whole country looking for answers here. Testimony before Congress today. Joining me first from Dallas in this hour is Lauren Silverman, health and science reporter at NPR, member station KERA. Lauren, thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks, Tom.
What's the status, as far as we know, of the health of the two nurses with Ebola? One still there, I think, and one who's been moved to Atlanta. Is that right?
That's right. There is one. The first nurse, Nina Pham, who's 26, she was the first nurse to be diagnosed here with Ebola, and she's still here and in good condition. We have the other nurse who was just transferred last night by plane. She walked out of the hospital and was able, so in good enough condition to do that. She is ill but stable, and she's at Emory, where they have special containment areas within the hospital that they are familiar with treating patients with Ebola.
Lauren, why was the second nurse, Amber Joy Vincent, 29, the one who flew, why was she moved to Atlanta at this point?
Great question, and we haven't received a clear answer about that, although there are many, many speculations. Some of the different reasons that could be are that there simply isn't enough, there aren't enough people to treat adequately more than one Ebola patient at Texas Health Presbyterian. Then there's also just international and national spotlight on Dallas, on this hospital, that make the success of treating any Ebola patient, the importance of that raised up a notch. And I believe that to try and perhaps refocus some of that attention they believed it's probably a good idea to treat her somewhere that's familiar with handling infectious diseases.
What's the best explanation or insight that we have so far, Lauren, about how these two nurses at Texas Health Presbyterian became infected with Ebola?
Well, it's true that we don't know for sure. What we do know is that the CDC is looking into a specific 3-day window of September 28th to September 30th. That is, September 28th is the date that Thomas Eric Duncan, the first Ebola patient who was diagnosed here, went into the hospital for the second time. You remember initially
right.
He was turned away. So once he came in for the second time, there were a few days before they got the confirmation from the CDC that he was, in fact, ill with Ebola, where the nurses were perhaps not, and not by no fault of their own, they were following guidelines, but they were not wearing hazmat suits, for example. So they could have had additional exposure in those first few days before the confirmation of Ebola came back.
Does the timing work out in that case? They didn't show symptoms for some days after. Does the timing of the emergence of their symptoms indicate that it could have been in that time when they weren't sure this patient had Ebola or not?
Yeah, well, it makes sense because it takes several days. It's usually about 8 to 10 days is what the CDC says is the time that it takes to begin showing symptoms, which is why we do have some good news, which is that the family and friends who were in contact with Thomas Eric Duncan, that first patient, not the healthcare workers, but the family and friends who are still self-monitoring or in isolation, have not shown any symptoms. That's 48 people, and they have passed that critical window of 8 to 10 days of a few weeks of showing no symptoms. So the likelihood of them having Ebola is less and less every day, and by Sunday they will be free to go about their business.
What about these comments we just heard from Judge Clay Jenkins saying they've got a situation involving 77 people? Are those all health workers at the hospital? Is the suggestion that they too may have been exposed, that they and maybe Amber Joy Vincent herself were walking around the hospital while infected?
Well, yes. So it's 75 people, including the two nurses who are now ill with Ebola. And the 77 is including lots of levels of nurses. We don't know. All of those nurses did not necessarily have direct contact with the bodily fluids of Thomas Eric Duncan, which the two nurses who are sick with Ebola did have. They did have direct contact with the bodily fluids of Thomas Eric Duncan. And the hospital says that the nurses who did have such high contact were not going about their business in the hospital treating other patients. It was only those nurses who they assessed to be at no risk to the other patients.
Maybe not in the hospital, but Amber Vincent did fly to Cleveland, back to Dallas. How did that happen?
Yeah, that was a big mistake, and the CDC head Tom Frieden said it was a big mistake. He's not denying that. She had a temperature that she reported to the CDC of about 99.5 degrees before she took that flight from from Cleveland back to Dallas.
Yep.
And the temperature at which they were supposed to tell her not to fly was 100.4, so she didn't reach the threshold for being a no-fly.
But here we are. Is there talk of that being revised now,
yes,
that 100.4?
Yes. Well, there's not actually talk about the changing the number because, as you can see, there's an issue with simply following protocol may not be enough. They need to either change some of the ways they're following protocol or just err on the side of being more cautious. So the Dallas County Judge Clay Jenkins, who's overseeing this here in Dallas, says that him and the medical director here are going to sign a control order that will make it not possible for people who are being monitored for symptoms of Ebola to use public transportation, to go on buses, to take flights, to do the things that are really concerning.
What's the public, perception right now in Dallas? Are people concerned that you've got potential Ebola carriers out and about in the community, or are people calm?
People are actually pretty calm. There's definitely a little bit of fear, and you can see some fear of foreigners, of foreign travel. But people overall are pretty calm, and definitely that it helps that the people who are educated to know, and the city has done a good job of telling people that this is not transmitted by air. This is only possibly transmitted if you've had direct contact with someone who's sick. Of course, it's not reassuring to hear now there may be other people who are sick that we don't know about.
Lauren, you cover health and healthcare. What does it say to you if this happened in a hospital like Texas Health Presbyterian there in Dallas, which has a pretty great reputation?
Yes.
If this happened there, first of all, does the hospital look at this as a debacle? It's certainly not good publicity, to say the very least. This has been called, the New York Times quotes someone waiting there for service calling it the Neiman Marcus of hospitals. What's their response to all this, and what does it say about the rest of the country and other hospitals and general preparedness?
Well, like you said, Texas Health Presbyterian has a great reputation. It was one of the most popular places here in definitely in Texas to have your baby. It has a very good reputation. So this, I don't think, is something that is isolated and unique to Dallas, to Texas. This could have happened anywhere. And hopefully the national spotlight, the international spotlight, will call attention to the fact that simply trying to follow CDC protocols isn't enough, and that the hospitals really are not as prepared as they thought they were.
What about their policy there at Texas Health Presbyterian? Will they treat Ebola patients in the future, or will they automatically send them off to one of these four super centers, Atlanta, Omaha, and beyond?
They have not said whether there will be any automatic sending of future Ebola patients. They said that they'll analyze it on a case-by-case basis, but it does seem to make sense, and a lot of medical experts say that it may, and nurses as well, say that it's a good idea to treat these patients in places that have nurses and other healthcare workers who are trained to do this kind of work.
Of course, we're also told that those four supercenters only have space cumulatively for 10
yes.
patients.
Yes, each one has a different amount of beds, so there is that concern. Hopefully it will not get to the point where we are looking for additional beds. The fact is the hospitals across the country that have isolation units can handle treating patients and stabilizing patients who have Ebola. It's really the concern is transmitting it to healthcare workers and figuring out whether and where, if there was a breach in protocol or if there was a mistake or simply something's wrong with the protocol, figuring that out and making sure other hospitals know what it is.
Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're talking this hour about Ebola in America, in American hospitals, the Dallas debacle. On September 30th, the day after the CDC confirmed the first case of Ebola in the United States had been diagnosed in Dallas, Texas Governor Rick Perry held a press conference at the hospital where that patient, Thomas Duncan, was being treated, praised the Texas healthcare system.
There is no place in the world, I will suggest to you, that has better professionals, better ability to address this than in Texas.
Patients now dead, two of the nurses at that hospital sick with Ebola. In a teleconference yesterday, CDC Director Dr. Tom Frieden said workers at the Dallas hospital tried to protect themselves better by adding more protective gear than they should have.
But in fact, by putting on more layers of gloves or other protective clothing, it becomes much harder to put them on, it becomes much harder to take them off, and the risk of contamination during the process of taking these gloves off gets much higher.
Joining me now from Washington is Elaine Larson, Associate Dean of Research at the School of Nursing at Columbia University. She's Professor of Epidemiology at Columbia's Mailman School of Public Health, editor of the American Journal of Infection Control. She's a registered nurse, a former infectious disease nurse. Elaine Larson, thank you very much for joining us.
Hi, Tom.
Everybody says, and we want to reiterate here, this is not a situation for panic. We just want to get on top of this and get on top of it properly. But clearly that hasn't happened so far in this Dallas hospital case, Elaine. Where does your mind go when you try and imagine what could have happened there? As other health workers around the country say, let's not repeat that, what should we be thinking about?
Sure. Well, let me describe the scenario from the point of view of the nurse who's in the room with this patient.
Yes, please.
They, first of all, they're covered with all this gear, as you know, which is like a spacesuit. Mm-hmm. Then they are in the room with the patient for hours because they can't come in and out. If they forget something, if they have to go to the bathroom,
yep.
If they're hungry, they can't go in and out.
Mm-hmm.
Every patient loses 5 to 10 liters of fluid every day. And that is diarrhea, vomitus, et cetera.
Right.
The nurse is there. She or he has to clean it up, has to comfort the patient, has to do all of the highly technical things that are required. So there's massive opportunity for contamination because the skin and all of the body fluids are infectious. Now, years ago, when I was a younger nurse,
yep.
I worked on an infectious disease unit in a hospital. They don't have those much anymore because we haven't needed them that much.
Mm-hmm.
But when we went out of the patient's room, we gowned up, not quite as much as it is today. we had an ante room where we took off everything, and we had a buddy system. We called it the clean nurse who was outside the door, who watched, helped make sure that we didn't contaminate ourselves and double-bagged anything that was contaminated. And I think one of the things that is going to be very helpful is CDC's recommendation that perhaps we need a buddy system again. So, in fact, all over the country now, there's a conference call today at 1:30 for all nurses around the country that's being held by the ANA. And I'm right now at the American Academy of Nursing, and they are actually announcing this morning that this is the group that whose mission it is to sort of transform health policy and practice. They have formed a group to task force to address the long-term implications of emerging infections and our public health and research infrastructure. One of the problems, as I'm sure you're aware, is that the public health infrastructure has sort of crumbled a little bit in the last few decades because, you know, we've sort of become less concerned, and now this is going to raise our concern again.
But long-term doesn't sound, I mean, that's important, obviously, but these are very near-term concerns.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, now the American Academy of Nursing is a smaller group who takes sort of a longer-term view, similar to the Institute of Medicine, which is also going to make some longer-term public health recommendations. But in the meantime, every hospital that I'm aware of, for example, I work in New York City, we have next week sponsored by the Greater New York Hospital Association, a three-hour session in the Javits Center, which you may know holds thousands and thousands of people. So we expect thousands of nurses and other healthcare workers who will come. The CDC will be there. The New York City Health Department will be there, and they'll be demonstrating how to put on and take off this gear.
And when is that, Elaine?
It's on October 21st between 10 a.m. and 1 p.m.
I mean, even that is days away now. I guess that's a great thing, but you'd think we would be getting that information out right away.
Oh, it's out, and it's on the web and so forth. But, you know, people need to practice, and every hospital now, in fact, the reason I'm talking to you is because I'm not in the hospital deployed to work on Ebola. So every hospital is developing an emergency plan.
Developing, but Ebola's here, and I want to ask about exactly what it is that's out there. I mean, this was a conference call yesterday with nurses talking about the lack of preparedness and training and equipment to fight Ebola. Even when they've seen material from the CDC, here was one unnamed nurse in that call.
We were told that we don't have goggles. They said that they couldn't afford the goggles.
Okay, can't afford the goggles. Great. And here, Elaine, this is an interview with Dallas-based Fox affiliate KDFW. This is a neighbor of the second Dallas nurse who was infected with Ebola, Amber Vincent, saying that the case just hit too close to home. He was her neighbor.
We were talking about yesterday at work, talking about, you know, what if it gets closer than the Presbyterian Hospital, and, you know, what are we going to do from there? And wake up this morning, it's like right next door to our apartment.
Boom, it's his neighbor. And here, listen carefully to this with us, if you would, Elaine. This is back on September 29th. This is Dr. Edward Goodman, epidemiologist at Texas Presbyterian, saying that the health workers caring for Thomas Duncan were wearing the proper protective gear.
What the staff are doing now is they're wearing water-impermeable gowns. In fact, they're wearing two of them because the gowns open in the back and it's hard to tie them close. So they have one gown that's in the back and the other gown tying in the front. They're wearing gloves. They're wearing surgical masks, and they're wearing eye protection. And they're wearing, because the patient did have diarrhea, they're wearing shoe protection as well.
Elaine Larson, what we've heard subsequently is that nurses there didn't know what they were doing in many ways. They were putting on layer after layer. They were putting on tape all over the place. We heard Tom Frieden saying, don't do that. If you put on too much, you're in trouble. I mean, what should be worn at what point in dealing with these patients or potential Ebola patients, Elaine?
Yeah, you know, I think this is a terrific question, and I think the problem is primarily we've all been trained, but clearly there needs to be retraining right now, and it is going on right now, because the problem, the time when the contamination is likely to occur is taking off the garb. And that is not easy. So that's why we need people to demonstrate again, to re-demonstrate. And it is true that the nurses are doing a terrific job. They are absolutely amazing, and it is our job. But when I was working on an infectious disease unit, it took, you get better at it as you're doing it. So clearly everybody's got to be deployed and retrained. There's, there's a call today at 1:30, which will also go through all of this training as well. So I think we're getting there. This is not the first time it's happened. You remember SARS, and then, of course, you know, there's the MERS outbreak in Saudi Arabia. So it's just a constant reminder about the fact that we've got risks. This one is dramatic, and there are a lot of things we don't know. Let me just respond to your question about why the long term. Yes, we need the short term. That's moving along, and it's moving faster and faster. And actually, until we are all prepared, I think it's a good idea to send the patients to, to Emory or wherever. And they have special built rooms. They have a special built lab separate from the lab.
But they only have 10 beds, and that's Emory plus Omaha plus Missoula, Montana plus Bethesda, NIH. 10 beds we're hearing.
That's right. And so I don't think we're going to see that many more patients coming here. Why don't we deploy people, which we're also doing, which CDC is doing and the Army, to the places where the people are. It seems to me that one of the highest risk times is when people are first to get on a plane, even when you know they're diagnosed, regardless of all the care, they get on a plane, they have to get off at the airport, they have to get in an ambulance, they have to get right into a room. So it seems to me that one of the things we need to be doing is sending highly trained teams of healthcare workers, nurses, physicians, to places where people are, where they won't have to be transported. And I have a feeling that's one of the things that's going to happen, so that we're not going to see so many cases here.
We hope you're right, but there's been lots of good talk, and so far, lots of reports of lack of preparedness. She flew on that flight, of course, and now Frontier Airlines is reporting it's grounded 6 crew members. We hope that's just from an abundance of caution.
Right.
This was, again, at this news conference yesterday, National Nurses United. This was the executive director, Roseanne DeMauro, saying nurses are concerned about a lack of Ebola preparedness at hospitals all over the country.
We've been attempting to try to get hospitals in this country to actually hear the nurses, hear the concerns. We've been told a lot of things that have been wrong. We've been lied to in terms of the preparation in the hospitals, because we know this because the nurses are telling us this.
This just does not sound like stopping it in its tracks. That was the CDC description of what would happen if it came here. Judith in Acton, Massachusetts, you're on the air with Elaine Larson. Judith, thanks for calling.
Yes, hi, Tom.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call. I'm not a medical provider, but I work in the garden sometimes, and I remove poison ivy. It's a contaminant, basically.
Mm-hmm.
And I've always fully suited up and worn 2 gloves. And when I am done, I take off the first pair, which is extremely contaminated.
Mm-hmm.
Then I remove the rest of my outfit. And I went to the CDC and looked at their protocol, and I was stunned because they say basically there's 2 versions of removing. And in the first one, you remove your glove, and then you remove all the rest of your gear, your goggles, your headgear. And I'm thinking, and it keeps saying, if you get contaminated, then wash your hands immediately, but then continue on the protocol. And I'm thinking, wait a minute, you're touching all this other gear that is potentially contaminated. So,
we get it. Even a gardener looks at that and says, wait a second. Elaine Larson, take us through that. Is it 1 layer of gloves, 2 layer of gloves? And if you get down to skin, what, you're getting a chlorine bath as you go here? Is that right? How do you get all this stuff off without contaminating yourself if there's a speck of Ebola infection?
Right. The CDC recommends double gloves.
Perhaps so. Judith just went to their website and thought she saw single, but double sounds great. How do you get down to that final level of skin and be certain that you don't have infection on yourself?
Well, I guess you never can be totally certain, but there are, you know, they're also using disinfectant types of sprays and other things as well.
Elaine, stand by there in Washington. Joining us now from San Francisco is Robin Gershon, professor of epidemiology, biostatistics at the Philip Arley Institute for Health Policy Studies, School of Medicine, School of Nursing at the University of California, San Francisco. She's former director of biological safety at Yale University, where she worked with many level 3 and 4 biological hazards. Ebola is a level 4 agent. Robin Gershon, thank you very much for being here.
Hi, Tom. Thank you.
And I don't know if you've heard this yet, but I'm just looking at a headline here from your old stomping grounds, Yale, New Haven, saying officials say that Yale New Haven Hospital is waiting for test results on a patient who recently traveled to Liberia and was admitted Wednesday night, last night, with a fever. How are we doing, Robin? Are we stumbling?
Well, I think that these events are inevitable, right? If WHO is saying 10,000 new cases a week, inevitably some of these cases will come to the U.S.
You mean in Africa? Yes, 10,000 a week at this point.
10,000 cases in Africa at this point. And when that happens, they are going to make their way to all the various places in the U.S., and we're scrambling right now to be ready, but it's a bit of a learning curve for us.
There's a big difference between we will stop it in its tracks and this is inevitable. To a lot of Americans, that may be an unacceptable difference.
We're in the early stages of this epidemic. We still have a lot to learn, including truly all the routes of transmission, what exactly we need for personal protection. There are many, many things still to be answered yet. I think you can see how we're scrambling. Every day we're seeing more and more information coming out of the CDC. So they're refining it as they go, but this is the very early stages. We have to be patient.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. You know, honestly, I don't understand that, Robin. You've got Doctors Without Borders and many others working very, very closely with this Ebola outbreak in Africa. They have for many months now. We've been reporting on it since early summer or spring. They have procedures that have kept their doctors, I think, with Médecins Sans Frontières. I don't think they've had any fatalities. I mean, learning curve, surely it's there already. It looks more like a failure to adopt learning that's already been done.
But remember, these people are highly trained, highly specialized. They have an incredible culture of safety that's embedded. They have at the highest levels of training and protection. I believe that everything they do is in a buddy system.
Shouldn't we expect from our CDC that they've imported that by now? There's been months that this has been building in West Africa. How can it be that we're only doing the teaching when it's already here?
Well, maybe there was some magical thinking going on that it might not get here, but obviously that's not the case.
Yeah.
I think that, you know, our hospitals are not geared for these high-level biocontainment agents. When I was at Yale and working with these level four, those agents were in a biocontainment unit, in a biosafety cabinet. I used to have to take 4 or 5 or even 6 showers every day in and out of those dirty rooms. We don't have those kinds of facilities in every single hospital. Very few, as you know. You just said 10 beds. So it's going to need, I like this idea that CDC is now floating that we may take these patients to these very well-equipped high containment facilities. These people are well-trained. The average nurse is not used to wearing a hazmat suit.
Do you think we're going to stop this in its tracks, or are we going to have some significant bout of Ebola here before we get a handle on it?
I think there's been a high learning curve. I think arguably the CDC is the best public health center in the world, let alone, of course, the U.S. It's our major center. They've had a lot of experience. Tom Frieden has an unbelievable track record and has the highest degree of success in all of his other past endeavors. I can't believe for a second that he's not going to get this under control. CDC has a huge contingent of unbelievably well-trained people, very motivated, devoted, and they're deploying those people from CDC and NIOSH and elsewhere. I think it's a matter of time. I'm sure within the next few weeks we're going to get a much better handle on.
Robin Gershon, please stand by there in San Francisco. Elaine Larson in Washington. Jonathan Cohn joins us when we return. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about Ebola in America, in American hospitals. what happened in Dallas, warnings from nurses, frontline workers all over, and what it's really going to take to make this country ready. We were told we'd stop it in its tracks, but that's not exactly what has happened so far. Everybody's saying don't panic. Good, that's always the correct response. But some serious questions also need asking at this point. We're beginning to do that right here. Robin Elaine, I want to welcome to our conversation right now from Ann Arbor, Michigan, Jonathan Cohn, senior editor at The New Republic. He's been closely covering the response to the Ebola virus in the United States. Jonathan, thank you very much for being here.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Testimony today before Congress, and I'm sure that'll be a tough grilling. Everybody wanted to believe that we were ready to go on this front. It's not as though this showed up in West Africa yesterday. It's been months in the building there, Jonathan. What do you see so far in the American response?
Well, I would make two points. First of all, just to reiterate the no panic line, there's a lot of noise out there, a lot of concern about what we're seeing. You know, only two people in this country have gotten the disease here. There will be more cases. I think experts always thought there would be. But at the moment, you know, there's no reason to doubt the forecast that this will be a very small contained disease here. But there has been failures. And I think the biggest one we're seeing right now is that the CDC, I think the authorities, believed that by sending out some guidelines, we would see action at hospital levels and that the nurses and doctors would be capable of simply reading these guidelines and putting in place the proper procedures and material. And I think we're all learning now the hard way that it's not that easy. You need to learn this. Your guests have already talked about this. The procedures are complicated. They're doable. As you said, Doctors Without Borders has been doing this forever with, you know, in the middle of tents in Africa. Mm-hmm. So it is feasible. But, you know, you have to be trained. You have to get instruction. I look at the response. I think one of the biggest failures was the CDC not recognizing right away that when somebody shows up with Ebola-like symptoms, they need to not just send investigators to find out, which they did. You know, they sent investigators to find out, gee, who was this person? Who else might have been infected? They also needed to send right away teams of infection control specialists to these hospitals to oversee how they were handling the patients. They're doing that now. And that's the right thing. This is one of the reasons I have confidence that this will not be a major outbreak. But frankly, it needed to happen at the beginning.
I mean, you wonder if the language is all correct and some of the formal steps, but if there's still just kind of a general complacency since we haven't been confronted with this kind of thing that requires such rigor in its handling. Jonathan, stand by. Lots of callers for all three of you. Mary in Springfield, Ohio. Mary, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom.
Hi. You're on, Mary. What do you think?
Well, there are several issues. First of all, your caller from California had it right in terms of we're just beginning to see this. I come from the heartland. I'm living in Ohio, and I'm concerned with our, you know, index case that's been up in Akron over the weekend and that we may be seeing more here. I work at a large community hospital, and I can tell you that the only people who are experienced in how to appropriately take off gowns and gloves and decontaminate are surgical personnel, nursing, maintenance staff, lab workers on a regular daily basis, you know, just don't know how to do this because the organisms we typically face are not as highly contagious and pathologic as Ebola.
So what do you think about the way we're communicating about this so far, Mary?
I think it's horrendous.
Why?
I think CDC, there's this political need, not just in the U.S., but across the world, to soothe people, to keep them from panicking. And there are places where we shouldn't be panicking. For instance, it didn't magically grab these two nurses. You know, it doesn't happen just by mm-hmm. jumping. There has to be body fluid contamination. However, we're not getting appropriately, I think, upset about how easily transmissible it is in the general public. For instance, people are being checked three times at the Monrovia airport before they leave Liberia for fever. But that only identifies the active cases. Once they're out of the country, once they're on the plane, we don't know when they're developing the actual disease. And it's when they develop symptoms that they become much more infectious. So the fact that they're developing 10,000 new cases a week in Africa tells us we're going to be seeding the world with this eventually. So it's not just about hospital personnel and, quote, containing it here, getting on top of it. It's about all the new cases we're going to see regularly, and we're not going to have enough beds eventually anywhere.
I want to talk about that potential inflow, and I appreciate your call, Mary. One more, Debbie in Newton, Massachusetts. Debbie, you're on.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
We've been hearing a lot about hospital preparedness, or in this case, lack thereof. My concern is that this is not affecting just hospitals. Lauren Silverman reported that the CDC suspects that the two infected nurses were actually exposed to the patient's bodily fluids prior to his diagnosis.
Mm-hmm.
So that was before there was even any thought of any kind of protective gear.
Right.
Now, somebody returning from West Africa with symptoms could seek care in any medical setting. It could be a primary care, it could be a clinic, and the symptoms that they present with are ordinary. It's fever, vomiting, diarrhea.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess my question is, shouldn't everybody be with these symptoms be screened for traffic to West Africa first thing, right off the bat? Now, my daughter works in a community health center in Boston, and it's a place that treats immigrants. You know, it treats underserved
yep.
populations.
Mm-hmm.
They have not been told. They've said, well, look out for these symptoms. Well, these symptoms are very common, and they have not been told to ask about travel. So it looks as if it may be that a very dangerous time is prior to diagnosis. And so my question for your experts is,
yep.
shouldn't all medical personnel doing intake be screening for West African travel?
Robin Gershon, how do you respond?
Yes, I think that's a great point. I've been thinking a lot about that in terms of clinics in the community, physicians or nurse practices. The only thing is that I'm not sure how we're getting out that message, because when I went to the CDC website last night, I did not see something that was exactly saying what this last caller said, which is, how do we reach those practitioners? How do we educate them? What about all the people who did not travel to West Africa, but in fact may be a neighbor, a roommate, may have sat on the plane? So we have to have a high degree of suspicion right now.
Elaine, that leaves me again feeling a sense of unreality about the way we're responding to this. Debbie's quite right. There are so many places that a person could come in for help. But if a bunch of them are not getting communicated with by the CDC, are we just dancing around the totality of the problem?
Sure. And I think the other side of it is that these symptoms, as the caller pointed out, are terribly, terribly common. And that's one of the problems. In fact, I'm sitting here with my cough drops and my cough suppressant to try to keep from coughing during this call. And the symptoms are just not very specific at first. So I agree with Robin, who in fact is an old colleague of mine, and hello, mm-hmm. Robin, that we've got to have a very high level of suspicion on the one hand, but a very fine line with, you know, let's not get so scared that we can't take the subway or whatever. So, yeah, and I have to say, one of the early nurses who said that their hospital said that they couldn't afford
goggles.
Mm-hmm. That's just appalling. That should not happen. That should not happen anywhere in this country. And if any hospital says that, then, you know, there's got to be some recourse for that. I don't know what individuals can do, but that is absolutely appalling.
Jonathan Cohn, of course we want to be able to take the subway, and we want to be able to do everything else. But here's this Frontier Airlines with the CDC giving a green light to the nurse who is now down with Ebola to fly. That plane was cleaned, but not in a, you know, infectious disease way. It went on to do 5 more flights full of people in addition to the 130 who were on her flight. I mean, the basis for going on with our good and important everyday life is that we've got a medical arena that's really on top of this, Jonathan.
Right. And, you know, obviously this has not been the finest hour for the CDC. And I think this is that you are seeing people questioning, and that's bad. And that is why the public authorities need to step up their game. you know, having said all that, all of the experts I've spoken to are very confident that we are still talking about a small number of people. This is not something – you are not going to see a massive outbreak. People are not going to be picking this up on the subway. They're not going to turn up with everyone on that flight getting Ebola. Probably nobody on that flight got Ebola. And so, you know, the hard part here is, you know, calibrating our attitude. We don't want to panic. We do want to show concern, in part because concern is helpful. I was thinking about the clinics and the need, and that's absolutely right. You know, anybody who sees in the medical business who is at that sort of front door, you come in, you know, it's a clinic, it's a walk-in clinic at your CVS, whatever. You know, we want now, if anyone has any of the symptoms of Ebola, one of the first questions should – and yes, they're common symptoms. You know, the question should be, have you been to West Africa? Or are you, you know, close with someone who has been to West Africa? Unfortunately, we do have a very fragmented healthcare system. It is not that easy to just snap your fingers and make changes in the way people practice. This was part of the problem at Texas Presbyterian. However, the fact that this is getting a lot of publicity, that people are aware of it, I can assure you that if I – you know, most people at this point have heard about this. So if I'm working at a clinic, I think you're going to – you know, just the extent to which people are now talking about it will help us. And you will see most people who are seeing patients starting to ask, hey, you know, are you – do you have any of the risk factors? And the trick here is going to be calibrating that in a way that we are duly cautious and that we are being diligent, but we don't panic. I do think it's possible, and I'm an optimist. I think we will get there. But, you know, it's going to be difficult.
You've got to keep an eye on the real difference between real seriousness and panic. I mean, carelessness clearly won't cut it. And we're hearing today at a lot of intake centers, people are not prepared right now. We're looking at Ebola in this country and how we are dealing with it. David in Nashville, Tennessee. David, you're on.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yes.
I'm an emergency department nurse in Nashville. And back to your last caller's comment, with not being frightened, not being scared to take the subway, we are entering flu season. And, you know, as previous callers have mentioned, the initial signs and symptoms of Ebola look a lot like that of a cold or a flu. So I guess we've talked a lot about personal protective equipment and putting on and taking off gloves, but these screening processes, I believe, are going to be the crux of fighting this epidemic or potential epidemic in this country. I think it goes without saying that we wouldn't be having this conversation if that initial patient in Dallas had been screened properly and was picked up in the emergency department.
Right, and if word had gone up the line, what about in your emergency room, David? Do you see appropriate screening going on now?
Well, I think there's just a lack of appropriate questions to ask. You know, we have the travel screening advisory at work in our emergency department, but as we've kind of talked about, as this spreads to Dallas and Ohio and, you know, Atlanta, those are all areas around Nashville. The question is, you know, how many cities do you include on that travel advisory outside of, you know, only asking about West Africa as this thing continues to grow? I think, you know, we're just lacking in the appropriate questions to ask.
David, I appreciate your call from Nashville. Robin Gershon, does this country, given what's going on with our public health system, given how long it's been since we've seen, I don't know what a comparable potential threat would have been. Do we know how to lace up our shoes and do it right here? Is the right attitude waiting out there to be tapped?
Well, you know, I've been studying public health preparedness for disasters for about a decade, and we have to get this right because my studies show that about 50% of all healthcare workers will not show up for work if they believe that they are at risk. So we must instill that sense of trust. We must ensure that they have the proper gear and the proper training. It's going to take a while to ramp that up, obviously, and that's why I like this idea of at least focusing on the few places in the U.S. that have this expertise already in place, maybe comparable to the Doctors Without Borders.
Jonathan, what do you think is throwing the lag into the U.S. response here? You know, we were told we were going to be right on top of it. We're not right on top of it.
This is such a new agent.
Yeah. Jonathan?
Well, you know, some of this is the fact that we are a very big country with a very fragmented healthcare system. And it's, as I said, it's not as if the CDC can dictate something that easily and instantly make it happen. And I think we're learning that there are assumptions about what is happening and what capabilities and what supplies are available on the front lines. And we're learning quickly that they are not – that is not the case. You know, I was speaking recently with a physician at a major research hospital, and this physician was telling me about, you know, they were starting to drill for this because, of course, like every hospital now, they're taking this seriously and getting ready. And, you know, on paper, they had all the equipment and they had all the procedures, but, you know, it was one of these, well, wait, where is it? What do we have exactly?
How exactly, you know, do I get out of this suit that I got myself into without smearing anything anywhere?
Right. Exactly. So, you know, there's going to be a learning curve. The good news is I do – you know, again, if there is a – you hate to say there's a silver lining to something like this, but if there is a silver lining to what has happened in Texas, it was a wake-up call. And I think now everybody is going to take this seriously. You're going to see hospitals around the country taking this seriously. You're going to see the CDC get a sense that, okay, this is the hand we have here. How do we play this? And, you know, I do think – we will get on top of this.
Elaine, and, is the expertise out there and the readiness to hear the wake-up call and respond in the right time frame?
Yeah, I just got back from a large infectious disease week meeting in Philadelphia, and the fellow who was in charge of the unit at Emory talked about some of the things that actually we hadn't anticipated, one of them being the challenges with waste disposal, but we're learning quickly, and we're going to share that expertise across from these expert places into the other places that aren't ready.
Let's do it, and do it fast. Elaine Larson at Columbia University, Robin Gershon at the University of California, San Francisco, and Jonathan Cohn with the New Republic. Great to have all of you with us today. Thank you so much. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR.